Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tour.com podcast. I am Justin Landon, and I've got some excellent guests on the show today. You'll remember one of my first guests about a year ago was Joe Monti. Tonight, Joe is back, joined by one of his launch title authors, Ken Leo. Ken is the author of many short stories. His most well-known story is probably The Paper Menagerie, which won the World Fantasy Award, the Hugo Award, and the Nebula Award, which I believe was the first time that ever happened. He's also won a Hugo for his story, Mono no Aware. Grace of Kings is his debut novel, coming out any day now from Saga Press. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you, Justin. Glad to be here.
The aforementioned Joe Monti is the executive editor for Saga Press. He is a former book buyer for Barnes & Noble, a former agent with clients like Ken Leo. This is his second appearance on Rocket Talk. Welcome back, Joe.
Hi.
So before we get this show started too much, I'm very curious, how long have the two of you been working together?
Oh my gosh. Joe, you want to recount the history?
It started actually with an anthology that Toby Buckell and I were working on called Diverse Energies. And Toby said, you know, should take a look at this guy, Ken. He's a really good writer.
Well, thank you, Toby.
He's the one who matchmade us. Because of that, Ken was in the anthology. And the anthology was a YA dystopian, also an answer to Race Fail and all the stuff going on at the time, 2009, 2010. And so that's how Ken and I met. And from there, I then wooed him over to working together with me. And so, 4 years-ish?
I think so. Maybe even longer.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
So you were agenting when you were also doing that anthology?
Yes, it was a charity for me. I mean, I donated it, any proceeds I had, to the Carl Brandon Award and the Peter Butler Scholarship. I might have that back with the Carl Brandon Scholarship and the Peter Butler Award.
Grace of Kings was where at this point, Ken?
It was already in rough, very rough draft form, I think, at that point, when I first started working with Joe.
You have this rough draft novel, and Joe signs you as a client at that point?
No, Joe did not get to see it until much later. I would not let him see it.
I feel like there's something there where Joe's like begging to see it, and you're basically telling him he can't.
Yeah, cool. I told him it was not ready.
Okay. So Joe signed you based on your short fiction.
That's right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. And so then when did Grace of Kings get into shape for you to actually, you know, show a human being that could help you determine its future?
Oh my gosh. Was it around the time, was it 2013, 2012? I'm trying to remember, Joe.
No, it was 2014, really.
2014.
It was,
okay.
It really was, yeah.
So much later, actually, than even I remembered.
So that's funny because I remember having a conversation with Joe at some point about this, and it was one of those things where this had sort of been something that you had been working on for a long time, and I kind of got the impression that it's something that Joe had been working on with you for a long time, but it was more like Joe was working on you to see it.
That's one way of putting it, yes.
So did the project start as a novel, or did it kind of, I mean, since you've written, obviously, a immense amount of short fiction, did Grace of Kings start as something you were saying, I'm going to write a novel and this is going to be my deal, or did it kind of start off as something else?
It did start as a novel, but a much shorter one. So what happened was, you know, I had written a lot of short fiction. I wanted to try a novel, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I was trying to figure out a story that would work as a novel. And then NaNoWriMo rolled around, and so I was like, well, I'm just going to do it. This is a perfect time to try to do one. And my wife, Lisa, at the time, and I were actually, she was trying to encourage me to do a novel, so she offered to actually write it with me as a way to get me to participate. And we talked about what sort of story would make a good novel, and she suddenly suggested that both she and I had grown up on these very old Chinese romance, historical romances. These are foundational narratives in Chinese literature, much like Western epics like the Iliad and the Odyssey and Beowulf are foundational for Western readers. These stories are retold and reimagined in various ways, and they're often among the very first stories that children learn. So both Lisa and I had been exposed to this as children. She was exposed to them through TV dramas in Hong Kong. And I got exposed to them because I grew up in China. And when I was a little kid in grade school, they had these Pingshu storytellers on radio who would tell these stories, like Romance of the Three Kingdoms. And I rushed home every day during lunch break so that I could sit with my grandmother and we both turn on the radio and just listen to it, mesmerized for like an hour before I had to go back to school. And so the stories are very foundational for both me and Lisa. And she said, you know, you really like these stories and like these stories. Why don't we try to reimagine these stories as a contemporary Western form? And I thought, oh, that was just a brilliant idea. So she and I sat down together and we sketch out the world together and try to figure out what kind of world we wanted to reimagine the story in. We discussed a lot of the decisions that ended up making to the final book. And of course, because at the time our first child was just a baby, it ended up being the case that Lisa was just way too drained to be able to really do any writing. So I ended up doing NaNoWriMo by myself. But the world really was created by Lisa and I together. That's kind of how it started. The very first rough draft of the novel was much, much shorter than the tome that is being published. It was a NaNoWriMo novel. So, you know, not very long. And then it just steadily got revised and revised and revised and revised many times in subsequent years. So that's the basic story.
I think one of the things I kind of want to get at a little bit, Joe, I think one of the cool parts about having the editor of the project and for at least some short period of time, the agent on the project and the author is to kind of get a look at sort of what happened in the editorial process. Like as you got it, after all of these revisions, you got this, as Ken describes it, a tome put in your lap. What did you see when you first got your hands on this? Because for somebody who's read a lot of Ken's short fiction, it's a much different kind of style.
To put it mildly.
Yeah. You know, on the hand, absolutely. You think, oh, Ken's going to write a novel. It's going to be a science fiction novel. And, you know, that's at least what was in my head. And then here's this epic fantasy. And at first I'm like, oh, all right. And I kept thinking, yeah, it's the Iliad. And, you know, that's a very gross generalization. But, you know, I saw certain characters like, oh, okay, there's Hector, there's Achilles, you know, and this is through, you know, the first layer of, my thinking that, okay, this is the Western stuff. And then I started to see the Chinese influences, and I knew a little bit, enough to know what he was playing with. And, you know, after you get through a chapter or two, you're like, oh, this is something very different. And that's what's so exciting about it. It's as Ken was saying, taking the ancient forms and putting it into the modern form, which is the epic fantasy novel, which is a concept on its own that's just mind-blowing in it. A really fun way. So to answer your question, I got this thing and I'm like, wow, okay, we can sell this right now before you even finish it.
as you said, it was different tonally, and the thing that you observed was sort of the fact that it was an epic fantasy, not a science fiction. But there's something incredibly warm about Ken's short fiction, and like inherently, is at least the stories I've read of Ken's are very warm. And there's an interesting voice. Cold is the wrong word, but a little more removed, less intimate with the voice.
Yeah, and yet, you know, it's still character driven. Yeah, and this is what Ken's fiction does. You know, it takes the larger view and then boils it down to like these characters. And, you know, I think, you know, you can see the corollaries, between the short fiction and the novel once you actually start getting into it. And, you know, once you do, you see like, oh, well, this is actually very much like a couple of his novellas, for example, more than the shorts.
Talk a little bit about how your observances were first the Iliad and the Odyssey, because of the sort of the positioning of the mythic elements alongside the mortal ones. But I'd be curious to get Ken's commentary on, you know, perhaps a Western reader observes the Iliad and the Odyssey, a non-Western reader might pick up on Romance of the Three Kingdoms. Were you aware of that dynamic, Ken, when you were writing this, that was going to happen?
Yeah, that was sort of a deliberate choice, actually. So what I'm doing here is kind of, to me, very interesting, in that. So, as you know, I also do a lot of literary translation from Chinese into English. And so I've been doing a lot of thinking about the act of translation and how translation can be a practice, a performance art, but as well as, a metaphor for a type of creative endeavor. And so here I wanted to do a translation of a foundational narrative from the Chinese literary tradition into a new setting, for a new audience, using a combination of tropes and voices and narrative techniques that I took, both from Chinese sources and also from Western models. So the voice thing I wanted to talk about a little bit. One really interesting feature of a lot of these old oral epics like Beowulf, and the Iliad and the Aeneid to some degree, and also even Paradise Lost, is that there's a lot of, different levels of voices and perspectives going on in, an epic. And the Chinese historical romances, have the same feature. There are moments where the epic voice, or the historian's voice takes over. And you have this very broad War and Peace kind of sweeping view of the world. And you get the commentary on sort of this gnomic wisdom of the world, lament about the state of the world, chaos, about ideals, and these observations of a kind of weariness about the world. And then a moment later, it's going to switch into a very intimate perspective of individual characters, you know, as Hector and Achilles start making speeches on the battlefield, or in Romance of the Three Kingdoms, you have these generals facing off across the battlefield and start talking about the last time they had, you know, been drinking together or something like that. And this sort of abrupt shift is really, really critical to the way these mass narratives worked. And so I wanted to replicate that by taking a variety of tropes and techniques from these different sources and then combine them to create something that's new. So it's a translation of a foundational narrative, reimagined for a new aesthetic. And one of the things that I also wanted to say is, beyond the inspiration from the various epics and historical romances, the actual underlying story is taken from Sima Qian's histories. Sima Qian is China's first grand historian, and he wrote about the founding of the Han Dynasty through a series of very intimate biographical sketches of the individual characters involved. The Han Dynasty arose out of the chaos after the fall of the Qing Dynasty. And so he, Sima Qian, wrote these biographies of the main characters involved in this historical transition. And he, you know, he was sort of like writing these biographies like Plutarch's Parallel Lives, where he was telling the story of the individual people, but also telling a larger story about the society in which they lived. So he was switching between this historian's voice and then very novelistic, sharp details as he paints these portraits of people. And so that's the kind of the overall style I wanted to achieve. The idea of telling a sweeping story while zooming in very, very closely at individual moments, key moments, and telling the story of characters as they develop and engage in this massive conflict.
Yeah, so I think, you know, what you were perceiving, Justin, as distance is that kind of camera pulling in, pulling back. You know, it's that whole David Lean kind of effect from the 60s in some ways.
I think that's what makes the novel, it's not the only thing that makes the novel unique, but I think it is one of the things that makes it the most unique, sort of set against, you know, when you classify it as an epic fantasy. I think it stands out in epic fantasies for that reason, because a lot of epic fantasies, and if you put on your book buyer hat for a minute, Joe, a lot of epic fantasies do the thing where each character is a tight point of view on that character, and each of those characters interacts within a different level in the world, perhaps, but you rarely get away from that tight third person voice, and it's just that. And I think that's what really makes this stand out. How is the reader of that type of epic fantasy going to take to this? And I think that's something that, I was thinking about as I was reading it.
Yeah, it's something that I was thinking about as I was writing it as well. I think the fact that I was trying to do something that in a lot of ways harkens back to a much older, traditions is sort of a risky choice. But, I really think that was the right way to tell the story. You know, I wanted to give some focus to the foundational narrative, which is different from the foundational narratives of Western epics. And then at the same time, I didn't want to invoke the feeling of these old Western epics. It's a risky structure, and I'm hoping that I managed to pull it off.
So one of the classic things about the Western epics, I think the Iliad and the Odyssey in particular, is you get into a weird feeling of agency with your main characters, and it's always never clear, you know, who's pushing who and who's pulling who, and you know, is this, you know, say a character acting on their own behalf or being sort of put there by some mythical figure that's moving the chess pieces around on the board. And you certainly speak to that in the novel. You know, there is mythic gods that are interacting in some way. But
right.
But I think you made in my opinion, what looked like a very clear choice to not rob any of your characters of agency, to not absolve them from anything.
Right, right. That's right. In fact, the whole chess pieces analogy comes up explicitly in the novel at one point, where some character is wondering, you know, whether we are in fact merely pieces put on the board by the gods, and the choices we make are in fact only illusory. So there is this idea about agency and free will lurking in the background of the novel. But yeah, you're right. I made a clear choice that I think is probably closer to the way the Aeneid handled this, which is that you want to have the gods participate, and they stir the pot, and they want to achieve their goals, but their powers are limited, and in fact, they are frustrated again and again in their plans by the way humans do their own thing. The gods are not, you know, all powerful. They are more powerful than the humans, but they have, among themselves decided that there are certain things they would not do. And so they would leave, choices open to the individual characters. What they do is they guide and they manipulate and they try to channel events in the directions they want them to evolve in. But ultimately the decisions are made by the characters themselves and they have to take responsibility for that.
Joe, obviously, any writer of Ken's stature in the short fiction world is being courted at some point to write novels. And I think this is, I don't think I would be speaking out of school to say that this novel, Grace of Kings, is one of the more anticipated novels to come from a short fiction writer in a long time. And having been the agent and now the editor, I'm curious about what it was like. How often were people bugging you about a Ken Leo novel?
There was one particular editor who kept asking him, but, yeah, often enough, you know, and even, some oddball queries, like from quarters you wouldn't have expected. Because, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, not to put too fine a point because I think, they're different, but, you can make the analogy to, where William Gibson was 30 odd years ago to where Paolo was, particularly, 8 or so years ago, you know, and you know, where is that writer that's coming up in a big way? There are a few, and Ken's one of them. So, no, absolutely.
So it seems like in the old days, the pathway of writing a bunch of short stories to get to writing novels was pretty common. That seems to be less so true today, where people tend to pursue the money making opportunities, which may not still be as grand as perhaps people would like them to think, but, you know, certainly novel writing pays better than short fiction these days. So a lot of people go straight to writing novels. You know, Ken, you took a different approach. I think, you know, there are certainly others that did that too, like Elizabeth Baer. I'd be curious to get your take on what that was like, you know, why you did it that way. Do you think it was are you glad you did it that way? Do you think you learned a lot writing short fiction that helped you as a novel writer? Just kind of general thoughts about that.
It's an interesting question. I did it my way, so I can't say that I have a lot of insight into what the alternatives would have been like. You're certainly right that many, many, many successful authors go straight to novels and they don't do short fiction as sort of, you know, training. In fact, some of them learn to write short fiction after they've had very successful novel careers. I did it this way simply because I didn't know of any other way to do it. I had a very busy job as first as a programmer and then as a lawyer. And so the amount of time I could devote to fiction writing was very limited. And short fiction just seemed to me a much easier type of art to practice when you're constrained by timing that way. And I enjoyed the sort of immediate gratification from writing short stories in that you could have an idea and flesh it out and finish the story relatively quickly and then start sending it out for rejections, which I guess isn't such positive feedback. But the idea that you can actually finish something relatively quickly was very attractive. So, you know, I didn't think about writing novels at all when I started. I just wanted to write short stories to learn the art. It turned out that a lot of the things I learned as a short story writer were useful as a novelist, but not as much as I would have liked. What I mean is, there are a lot of things I did learn as a short story writer that translated into novel writing fairly well, and it was nice that I chose a structure for the novel that allowed those skills to play out. So one of the things about Chinese historical romances that may seem a little bit strange to someone who hasn't been exposed to them is that they tend to have many characters, and it's not always clear what the main thrust of the plot is. It's not the case that a lot of these historical romances have one or two heroes and then everybody else is just a secondary character. They tend to have many, many, many characters who all seem equally important. And so the way the plot moves forward is you would have the epic voice or the historic voice go on about laying out the general situation. And then suddenly you dive into this very intimate story about one or two characters. And then next chapter, you shift to a different set of characters and then their own intimate story. And you're wondering what happened to the bigger story, what happened to the main thrust. And then the plot sort of moves forward with these side stories of the secondary characters building up to each other. And that kind of structure is very helpful for a short story writer because you can treat the side stories of the secondary characters in epic fantasy, like I'm writing, as though they are separate short stories and just carve them off and write them that way. So that was helpful. But at the same time, a lot of the skills you learn as a short story writer are not translatable to a novel. For me, the main thing I had to learn was the fact that in a short story, you could keep everything in your head. But with a novel, even if you're writing a lot of side stories in addition to the main narrative, you still have to make thousands of decisions about world building, about plot, about timelines, about characters, about technologies, about cultures, that you just cannot keep on your head. I don't have that kind of memory, and I doubt many people do. I'm not a planner by nature. And so I had to learn the hard way that I needed to take very detailed notes and write a lot of background information to sort all these world building details out in my head. I ended up using a wiki system, and so I wrote a little Wikipedia entries essentially for everything. And so I ended up with a mini Wikipedia for the world. And that was the only way I could keep everything straight. The amount of effort that took surprised me a little bit, but of course, in retrospect, that makes perfect sense. It's just that when you've always been writing 5,000 word short stories, you don't realize that keeping everything in your head is not possible. And so I had to learn how to track very basic world building details
in a systematic way as I was writing the novel. I don't regret doing it this way by any means. You know, I love the novel. I think it's the best thing I've ever written, but I also think that my short fiction career was tremendously helpful in terms of launching my novel career. Without all the short stories I wrote, both to learn the craft and also to build a reputation, I think the novel would not have, it just wouldn't have been the same. So I don't regret the way I came this way, even though it took a long time to do the novel.
Joe, is from an editorial perspective, have you ever noticed a difference between people who came up in short fiction versus people who jumped in as novelists?
You know, thinking about this, no, I think that largely, you know, I mean, as Ken was saying, there are applicable skills that apply to both, but the two different forms. You know, I think science fiction fantasy is one of the few fields where there still is a robust short fiction market, and that you can still build a reputation. It's not like the old days where you can actually make a living doing this and then move on to write novels. But, you know, it happens in, you know, quote unquote literary fiction, but not exactly the same. There's a collection that comes out and if it has the right placement and all that. But it's not the same in fantasy science fiction where you have that story. They're like, oh, that story and that story, that's a writer to watch and build a career off of that. But in terms of the skill set, what you see on the prose level, no, hasn't been discernible.
When you were on the show last time, you talked about Grimdark and sort of the founding of Grimdark and how it came about and how it was perhaps fizzling to some degree or had reached a logical conclusion of some kind. In much the same way, I mean, I kind of look at what Grimdark did, and it sort of took the epic fantasy genre and it twisted it in a way to kind of make us look at it in a different way, in a useful way, I think. Do you think that what Ken is doing in this story has the potential to have that same kind of twisting impact on how we view epic fantasy?
I actually do. I think, you know, there's something I've always believed in back when I was a buyer, that when you had something successful, there was always the second wave. And what is that second wave? And that was something I always looked for. I always liked looking for patterns. And, you know, those patterns show up in weird ways at times. And sometimes it's a sales pattern. Sometimes it's a zeitgeist. Other times it's a prose level. And, you know, just to harken back a little bit, I think where we really are is, you know, George R. R. Martin's the Looming Shadow, right? But what he's really much more attuned to is historical fiction. Bernard Cornwell kind of stuff is what I think he's playing with, along with epic fantasy. But, you know, and Ken's taking that sort of perspective as well, but then adding in the mythological elements that George isn't. And so, in some ways it becomes even larger, right? The perspective is grander. And there's also a more measured level of hope. You know, that, is part and parcel of a heroic fantasy, you know, and, there are absolutely characters that are a heroic fantasy. You could take a couple of characters, Grace of Kings, and make a heroic fantasy out of them if you isolated them. And, the fact that this is a combination of that, I think, is really smart. And we'll see where this goes as far as the field. But, you know, I think where we're going is much more heroic and epic. And historical based, to some degree on the epic side.
Joe, I wanted to give you a big thumbs up from a marketing perspective from cramming in a Game of Thrones comparison. Excellent work. Your publicity department will thank you.
No, I'm trying to actually stay away from it, but you know, I really think it's not about that. It's not about, right. Like, oh, this is Game of Thrones. Absolutely not. I'm actually trying consciously not to do that at all.
But I think your point is well taken, which is that, you know, a lot of times people say that George is doing Grimdark or George is twisting epic fantasy, but I think The War of the Roses is the more apt comparison, perhaps, like this huge, broad, sweeping soap opera, really. And so, yeah, I absolutely see that comparison. And but I think one of the things that Grace of Kings does that A Song of Ice and Fire fails to do, which is perhaps A Song of Ice and Fire's greatest failure, is that it doesn't have the narrative flexibility to zoom in and out of things the way that Grace of Kings does. Like, I feel like the voice that Ken is using allows him to move through the plot in a different way.
That's the Chinese literature.
Right, he wants to cut to the point, he can cut to the point, where George has to back his way into the point, because he has so many things that he has to do, because he does use that tighter voice that I've talked about before.
Yep, Yep.
I think. And it's an interesting, comparison. There is something I want to bring up. There are not a huge number of chapters written from the point of view of women. Is this something that you thought about, Ken, or is it reflective of the genres that you're pulling from?
If you've gotten through the Gin Mizodi chapters, then you might have a different feel for it, but you might not. Depends. What I'm trying to do with the novel and with the series as a whole is to interrogate and to some extent critique the source material as well as the genre in which it lives. So one of the things that The Grace of Kings is concerned with is power. The ways that men and women use power, are corrupted by it, and are driven by it, and are in pursuit of it, and ultimately sometimes ennobled by it. And so one of the things that shifts throughout the book is, what are the ways that women can use power in a world that is, in a society that is at some level, very hostile to their use of power? The novel creates a world in which things are not perfect. It is a world in which women's use of power is frowned upon, in a lot of ways, suppressed. And so the women characters of the novel have to do various things to, challenge and sort of, make the best of a terrible situation. And yet, as the novel goes on, there is a hint of how things could be different. And the idea is that there is a longer arc that's being developed here. I think some of the readers who have finished the novel have said that the novel is very aware of the problem of gender relations in a world like this, because this is a world in which it is posited that men do most of the fighting. And because it's a novel about warfare, necessarily the way that men try to obtain and hold on to power becomes dominant. And women's way of trying to obtain power in this world, because of the way it's set up, is different. But the novel sort of questions why that is so. I think there's, you might remember, there's one point where the characters say, this is just by custom. This is not the way it has to be. And that's a hint of what's going to come. The first novel, The Grace of Kings, in this series is really about brotherhood and the many ways that honor and brotherhood gets corrupted in this pursuit of power. And so because it's so focused on brotherhood, it backgrounds some of the other relationships that are important in people's lives. And so as the novel nears its end, the women play a more dominant role, and they become bursting at the seams of the place that this world has set up for them. And that's a hint of sort of where, you know, book two and possibly book three is going. So I don't want to spoil everything, but there is an overall arc with the series that I want to achieve. And I don't want to create a world that is perfect from the beginning. It has to be a flawed world, because it's ultimately a series about power and the ways that people obtain power and try to seek justice with it.
I mean, this was something partially to answer your question. Like, was this something this is something we worked on editorially. I mean, this is something that's been very conscious throughout the development of the book. And again, you know, it's about that long view, you know, and I think it's also a perspective of culture, you know, where on the Western side, I mean, if you take a look at American culture, it's what are you doing in the next 2 months, not 5 years. And I think when you look at the literature that Ken's working off of, particularly, you know, it's that longer view again. And so where I think in a different structure, it may have more immediate results here, it's playing out, and it's going to play out to some degree generationally. Did I give away too much?
Right.
they're deliberate choices.
Well, I think the key thing that Ken said that I think will make a lot of people very happy is this. I think one of the biggest criticisms about epic fantasy over the years has been its obsession with the status quo, right? That the culmination of many epic fantasies is a return of the status quo, as opposed to a upsetting of the status quo.
I think it's important to sort of
point this out. This is a difficult question because I'm reimagining a story for a new audience, and so the easy answer would be, well, it's done this way because that's what the source material is like. Well, I mean, you know, the source material didn't have airships, and I have airships, so. You know, why did you make this choice? I think that's a totally fair question. And I think the answer is I made this deliberate choice because I am trying to tell a story about how people get justice. This is a story about two people, Kunigaru and Matazindu. And these two are polar opposites in a lot of ways. Kuni is sort of this, very lazy son of a farmer who really he doesn't study very hard. He doesn't try to do try to make something of himself. He really just would rather play drink and go wander around the markets with his friends. Matazindu, on the other hand, is the descendant of a very noble aristocratic family, and except the family has been destroyed really by an evil emperor who unified the islands. And deposed all the old nobles. So, Mata has grown up with the idea that he wants to seek vengeance and return things to the status quo because he believed that before the conquest by the evil emperor, when the land was divided into these separate seven kingdoms, it was much better because that was the natural state of the world. And the evil emperor upset that status quo and he needs to, it's his mission. It's the god's mission. With him as their avatar to carry out this idea of return to this golden age of the past before this evil oppressive emperor came to rule over everyone. Kuni, on the other hand, does not have that kind of nostalgia for the past. He sees that there are certain things good about this world after the unification. And so when the two of them become friends and gradually get involved in a mass rebellion against the evil emperor. It's really hard to see how the two of them can become friends because they have such different ideas. And yet they do. They do become good friends and they see how they complement each other and their strengths and weaknesses are good matches. But ultimately, you realize that because they're so different and they have such different ideas about how to make the world better, that the friendship just can't last, even though they're as close as brothers. It's coming that they're not able to sustain this and they're going to come into ultimate conflict. So that's sort of the main thrust of the novel. And so the themes here are very much focused on the idea of how do you use power to achieve justice and fairness and to make the world better. And part of that, is about, trying to, allow people who have traditionally been deprived of power to have more power. And so what you're talking about here about gender relations is one aspect of unfairness in this world. And it's a reflection of the source material, but it's not something that I'm going to slavishly copy. The very point of the story overall is to challenge existing power structures. You know, I mean, I call this novel in a marketing term, silk punk. And what does punk mean? It means that there has to be a resistance, a kind of rebellious attitude to it. So on the whole, that's kind of the point. The point is that the main characters, the characters that the readers are supposed to sympathize with, ultimately are the punks. They're the ones who want to upset the status quo and try to move to a more just world. And there are many forms of injustice, in the world of the novel when it's initially presented. There are gender issues, there are class issues, there are regional issues, and there's a little bit of a colonial aspect to the way the world is set up as well. And all of these things come into play over a very long arc. If I resolve everything, in a happy ending in the first book, then I think it's not as satisfying. The very point is to tell a very long, massive story. And so that's what I got set up. And the hope is that the reader can see that the narrative voice and the novel and the author are perfectly aware of these issues, and that they're not there because they're slavishly copied from some ideal source material, and they're not there because the author just decided that there's nothing wrong with the way things are. It's because they're set up for this long transformation.
usually the way you form these punk kind of terms is to by sticking some sort of power source or some sort of technology in front of it. Silk is neither technology nor a power source. It's an aesthetic. That's what I'm trying to go for here. I mean, the punk part, I explained, it's really about rebellion. It's about this attitude of challenging, what's there. The silk part is about an aesthetic. Like steampunk, which, you know, is very, very much derived from a kind of Victorian era aesthetic. And it's a mixture of, fantasy and science fiction. Silk punk, the way I'm using it, is an aesthetic that, tries to imagine a technology alternative, where many of the machines and technologies used in the novel are constructed from a vocabulary that's based on an East Asian historical model. So a lot of the materials used to construct these machines and mechanisms are from material of historical importance to East Asia. So bamboo, paper, silk, as well as other organic materials that are unique to the archipelago setting that I'm using. So coconut, coral, feathers, and so on and so forth. And then I take this set of materials and I construct a set of technology, vocabulary and grammar based on biomechanics. So the airships, in my novel don't work quite like the zeppelins of our timeline. Instead, these are constructed from bamboo and silk, and the way that they regulate their buoyancy is by compressing and expanding these very large lift gas bags. And the way they're propelled is through these huge feathered oars instead of propellers. So when one of these airships flies through the air at night, when they're lit up from within, they behave as the like some sort of jellyfish-like sea creature, pulsing and swimming through this very dark Empyrean sea of stars. And that's kind of the image that I want, this very biomechanics, organic, material-based, East Asian model-inspired kind of technology aesthetic. And I try to carry that aesthetic throughout the novel, and sort of punch it up a little bit more even, in the sequels. But the idea is to give people this really fresh look of an epic fantasy setting. We have chemical based tunnel machines. We have these airships. We have these battle kites. We have underwater boats. And we have these hot air balloons, essentially, which are actually based on real East Asian models, historical models. And so the overall effect really is, I really think silk punk, as I'm using it, is not entirely crazy. It is meant to be a technology vocabulary and aesthetic. I'm really trying to actually make the punk part as well as the silk part real.
I'll tell you, most times when I get a chance to interview an author about their book, it rarely provides this much of an insight into the actual work. And I think that, I hope that a lot of people that read this book take some time to listen to this either before or after they read it, because I think a lot of the things you've talked about tonight are going to really heighten their ability to read this book. And it makes me, because it has me rethinking a lot of the things that have happened in the novel through a different lens. Although it does make me wonder, I think to myself, like, we need to get some Romance of the Three Kingdoms copies out there for people to start perusing so they can read it side by side.
Well, I think this is, again, the paradigm shift in some ways of thinking about epic fantasy that we were talking about, about how it's that next wave.
I was really hoping to chat with you a little bit about the three body problem, but I feel like if we start talking about that, we're going to be here until tomorrow. So I will let you off the hook only to say that the three body problem, which you translated and came out last year, and which sequels come out later this year, was a fantastic read, and I'm very much looking forward to the sequels. And without keeping you here for another 15 minutes, I'd just love to get your thoughts about, what that was like, how gratifying it is to you to see that out in the world and see the reception to it.
Oh, I was really happy. I mean, the project was undertaken with some trepidation, I think both by me and by Tor Books, with Liz Gorinsky, as my editor. I mean, translated novels rarely, do well in the American market, and translated sci-fi novels, definitely don't do all that well. It was tough because, there are many things that the three-body problem does, that are very different from contemporary Anglo-American science fiction. Narratively, it has different, it draws on a different set of expectations. You know, Liu Cixin himself has said that this book is very different from American science fiction books being published right now. You know, I read them, I know what they're like, and Three Body is not like that. I wrote it for Chinese readership, and I had to do things a certain way, because that's the way Chinese readers like their books, but that's not the same sort of thing that American readers like. So, you know, I have no idea if they're going to like it. And so I think everybody involved in the project felt some trepidation. So it's been really gratifying, actually incredibly gratifying to see the many, many positive comments I received from readers who discovered this book and really enjoyed it. So I count it as a big win.
And you've read it as well, right, Joe?
Yeah, I was actually.
Yes, you're the agent, right?
He was, yes. I mean, you know, this is, in many ways, it harkens back to a certain style of science fiction that isn't written much. And yet it's very modern. And I think, you know, what's being explored there politically is also refreshing, because it's not, again, that perspective that you typically get in a science fiction novel. And so it's, you know, I mean, the analogy is, the only thing I can think of is really outside of the Arthur C. Clarke stuff, which is a little more obvious, but the Ken MacLeod's work, and things like that. And yeah, it's exciting to have this kind of thing get acknowledged in such a diverse way too. I mean, from the New Yorker, the New York Times, and within the field.
It's interesting that we got this science fiction novel last year, which I think you're right, touched on a lot of the when you say type of science fiction that's not written anymore. I mean, I kind of talked about it like it was a golden age science fiction novel, but completely reimagined by from a different perspective, right? And so, you know, and then a year later, we're getting The Grace of Kings, which is an epic fantasy completely reimagined with its own set of different expectations and such. So I think it's exciting that we're seeing these. And, I think it's gotta be exciting, Ken, to be kind of the guy on the front of that, the point of that phalanx.
Yeah, well, you know, it's exciting, and it's also nerve wracking. I mean, it's exciting because I am trying to do something different. I'm making a huge, number of decisions that are, I think, risky. I mean, you know, all the stuff that you asked me about today, these are risky decisions. That kind of very, sudden shifts in point of view and in terms of the way the timeline suddenly speeds up and slows down, and the way I jump very quickly between layers of voices, from this epic historian's voice down to the very intimate voice. These are not, decisions that are, these are not techniques commonly seen in contemporary works. It really does harken back to an older style. And, you know, some reader, I think actually more than a few readers, have read it and immediately said, this reminds me of War and Peace. And, you know, that was also one of those epic novels that I sort of had in mind as a model. Right. So is that kind of aesthetic, that kind of approach, this voice that's both old and new at the same time, something that people will like? You know, I have no idea. The market is going to have to decide. Similarly, the way I've decided to, set up a world that is not perfect, that have these systematic injustices in there, and that I'm trying to play the long game of showing people, challenging it and realizing it, realizing that it's not just, and trying to challenge it and possibly failing, within the first book before, you know, something else happens, possibly in the next book. The way I'm playing this long game is also risky. You know, who knows? I mean, are a lot of readers patient enough to get through 300 pages before they finally see one of the main female characters do
something quite dramatic and change the way that the book has been perceived. Are they patient enough to read through the whole first book and wait for the next book to see how this evolution in political system and power structures evolve? I have no idea. I mean, I'm doing a lot of things here that I think are risky. So it's exciting, but you know, I'm nervous.
And I would say that's where the art is, you know, because you're at that edge. You know, I think you look at books like Tahanu, you know, or even some of the other works. You know, you go back to Neuromancer again, you know, but that edge is where the art really shines through.
I'm very excited by the fact that you're pushing the envelope, that you're doing something new, and I think anytime you do that, you may have some people that don't like it, but you're going to have more people that appreciate the fact that you're taking a risk. And that's where we are at in the genre now, is we want risk. We want to see something new. We've been stuck in a rut, you know, sometimes for too long. So I'm excited for it. The book's going to be out on April 7th. If people want to know more about you, Ken,
they can go to my website, which is kenliu.name, kenliu.name. I actually have one of those .name domains back when they were being offered as sort of the future of personal websites, and I was being a good internet citizen and got one of those instead of a .com, because I was like, you know, I'm not commercial, I'm just a person. But anyway, so that's the website, and they can also follow me on Twitter, which is KYLYU99.
Thank you both so much for being here tonight.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
And this has been Rocket Talk.